Part 3. Life and Death. What will people of the future think of us? Will they say, as Roger Williams said of some of the Massachusetts Indians, that we were wolves with the minds of men? Will they think that we resigned our humanity? They will have the right. C.P. Snow. I see that as human beings we have two great ecstatic impulses in us. One is to participate in life, which ends in the giving of life. The other is to avoid death, which ends tragically in the giving of death. Life and death are in our gift. We can activate life and activate death. Gil Elliott. Chapter 18. Trinity. Within 24 hours of Franklin Roosevelt's death, two men told Harry Truman about the atomic bomb. The first was Henry Louis Stimson, the upright, white-haired, distinguished Secretary of War. He spoke to the newly sworn president following the brief cabinet meeting Truman called after taking the oath of office on the evening of the day Roosevelt died. "Stimson told me," Truman reports in his memoirs, "that he wanted me to know about an immense project that was underway, a project looking to the development of a new explosive of almost unbelievable destructive power." That was all he felt free to say at the time, and his statement left me puzzled. It was the first bit of information that had come to me about the atomic bomb, but he gave me no details. Truman had known of the Manhattan Project's existence since his wartime Senate work as chairman of the Committee to Investigate the National Defense Program, when he had attempted to explore the expensive secret project's purpose and had been rebuffed by the Secretary of War himself. That a senator of watchdog responsibility and bulldog tenacity would call off an investigation into unaccounted millions of dollars in defense plant construction on Stimson's word alone gives some measure of the quality of the secretary's reputation. Stimson was 77 years old when Truman assumed the presidency. He could remember stories his great-grandmother told him of her childhood talks with George Washington. He had attended Phillips Andover when the tuition at that distinguished New England preparatory school was $60 a year, and students cut their own firewood. He had graduated from Yale College and Harvard Law School, had served as Secretary of War under William Howard Taft, as Governor General of the Philippines under Calvin Coolidge, as Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover. Roosevelt had called him back to active service in 1940, and with able assistance, especially from George Marshall, and despite insomnia and migraines that frequently laid him low, he had built and administered the most powerful military organization in the history of the world. He was a man of duty and of rectitude. "The chief lesson I have learned in a long life," he wrote at the end of his career, "is that the only way you can make a man trustworthy is to trust him. And the surest way to make him untrustworthy is to distrust him and show your distrust." Stimson sought to apply the lesson impartially to men and to nations. In the spring of 1945, he was greatly worried about the use and consequences of the atomic bomb. The other man who spoke to Truman on the following day, April 13th, was James Francis Burns, known as Jimmy, 66 years old, a private citizen of South Carolina since the beginning of April, but before then for 3 years, what Franklin Roosevelt had styled Assistant President. Director of Economic Stabilization and then Director of War Mobilization, with offices in the White House. While FDR ran the war and foreign affairs, that is, Burns had run the country. "Jimmy Burns came to see me," writes Truman of his second briefing on the atomic bomb, "and even he told me few details, though with great solemnity he said that we were perfecting an explosive great enough to destroy the whole world." Then, or soon afterward, before Truman met with Stimson again, Burns added a significant twist to his tale. That, in his belief, the bomb might well put us in a position to dictate our own terms at the end of the war. At that first Friday meeting, Truman asked Burns to transcribe his shorthand notes on the Yalta Conference, 3 months past, which Burns had attended as one of Roosevelt's advisors and about which Truman, merely the vice president then, knew little. Yalta represented nearly all Burns's direct experience of foreign affairs. It was more than Truman had. Under the circumstances, the new president found it sufficient and informed his colleague that he meant to make him Secretary of State. Burns did not object. He insisted that he be given a free hand, however, as Roosevelt had given him in domestic affairs, and Truman agreed. A small, wiry, neatly made man, a team of contemporary observers describes Jimmy Burns, with an odd, sharply angular face from which his sharp eyes peer out with an expression of quizzical geniality. Dean Acheson, then an assistant secretary of state, thought Burns overconfident and insensitive. A vigorous extrovert accustomed to the lusty exchange of South Carolina politics. Truman essayed the South Carolinian most shrewdly a few months after their April discussion in a private diary he intermittently kept. Had a long talk with my able and conniving Secretary of State. My, but he has a keen mind, and he is an honest man. But all country politicians are alike. They are sure all other politicians are circuitous in their dealings. When they are told the straight truth, unvarnished, it is never believed. An asset, sometimes. A politician's politician, Burns had managed in his 32 years of public life to serve with distinction in all three branches of the federal government. He was self-made from the ground up. His father died before he was born. His mother learned dressmaking to survive. Young Jimmy found work at 14, his last year of formal education, in a law office, but in lieu of classroom study, one of the law partners kindly guided him through a comprehensive reading list. His mother, in the meantime, taught him shorthand, and in 1921 he earned appointment as a court reporter. He read for the law under the judge whose circuit he reported and passed the bar in 1904. He ran first in 1908 for solicitor, the South Carolina equivalent of district attorney, and made himself known prosecuting murderers. More than 46 stump debates won him election to Congress in 1910. In 1930, after 14 years in the House and 5 years out of office, he was elected to the Senate. By then he was already actively promoting Franklin Roosevelt's approaching presidential bid. Burns served as one of the candidate's speechwriters during the 1932 campaign, and afterward worked hard as Roosevelt's man in the Senate to push through the New Deal. His reward in 1941 was a seat on the United States Supreme Court, which he resigned in 1942 to move to the White House to take over operating the complicated wartime emergency program of wage and price controls, the assistant presidency of which Roosevelt spoke. In 1944, everyone understood that Roosevelt's fourth term would be his last. The man he selected for vice president would therefore almost certainly take the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 1948. Burns expected to be that man, and Roosevelt encouraged him. But the assistant president was a conservative Democrat from the Deep South, and at the last minute Roosevelt compromised instead on the man from Missouri, Harry S. Truman. "I freely admit that I was disappointed," Burns writes, with an understatement approaching lockjaw, "and felt hurt by President Roosevelt's action." He made a point of visiting the European front with George Marshall in September 1944 in the midst of the presidential campaign. When he returned, FDR had to appeal to him formally by letter, a document Burns could show around, to endorse the ticket with a speech. Burns undoubtedly regarded Truman as a usurper. If not Truman, but he had been Roosevelt's choice, he would be President of the United States now. Truman knew Burns's attitude, but needed the old pro badly to help him run the country and face the world, hence the prize of state. The Secretary of State was the highest-ranking member of the cabinet, and under the rules of succession then obtaining, was the officer next in line for the presidency as well when the vice presidency was vacant. Short of the presidency itself, state was the most powerful office Truman had to give. Vannevar Bush and James Bryan Conant had needed months to convince Henry Stimson to take up consideration of the bombs challenge in the post-war era. He had not been ready in late October 1944 when Bush pressed him for action, and he had not been ready in early December when Bush pressed him again. By then, Bush knew what he thought the problem needed, however. "We proposed that the Secretary of War suggest to the President the establishment of a committee or commission with the duty of preparing plans. These would include the drafting of legislation and the drafting of appropriate releases to be made public at the proper time. We were all in agreement that the State Department should now be brought in." Stimson allowed one of his trusted aides, Harvey H. Bundy, a Boston lawyer, father of William P. and McGeorge, at least to begin formulating a membership roster and list of duties for such a committee. But he did not yet know, even in broad outline, what basic policy to recommend. Bohr's ideas, variously diluted, floated by that time in the Washington air. Bohr had sought to convince the American government that only early discussion with the Soviet Union of the mutual dangers of a nuclear arms race could forestall such an arms race once the bomb became known. He would try again in April to see Roosevelt. Felix Frankfurter and Lord Halifax, the British ambassador, would be strolling in a Washington park discussing Bohr's best avenue of approach when the bells of the city's churches began tolling the news of the president's death. Apparently no one within the executive branch was sufficiently convinced of the inevitability of Bohr's vision. Stimson was as wise as any man in government, but late in December he cautioned Roosevelt that the Russians should earn the right to hear the baleful news. "I told him of my views as to the future of S-1, Stimson's code for the bomb, in connection with Russia, that I knew they were spying on our work but had not yet gotten any real knowledge of it, and that, while I was troubled about the possible effect of keeping from them, even now, that work, I believed that it was essential not to take them into our confidence until we were sure to get a real quid pro quo from our frankness. I said I had no illusions as to the possibility of keeping permanently such a secret, but that I did not think it was yet time to share it with Russia. He said he thought he agreed with me." In mid-February, after talking again to Bush, Stimson confided to his diary what he wanted in exchange for news of the bomb. Bohr's conviction that only an open world, modeled in some sense on the Republic of Science, could answer the challenge of the bomb, had drifted in Bush's mind to a proposal for an international pool of scientific research. Of such an arrangement, Stimson wrote that it would be inadvisable to put it into full force yet until we had gotten all we could in Russia in the way of liberalization in exchange for S-1. That is, the quid pro quo Stimson thought the United States should demand from the Soviet Union was the democratization of its government. What for Bohr was the inevitable outcome of a solution to the problem of the bomb, an open world where differences in social and political conditions would be visible to everyone, and therefore under pressure to improve, Stimson imagined should be a precondition to any initial exchange. Finally, in mid-March, Stimson talked to Roosevelt, their last meeting. That talk came to no useful end. In April, with the new president in the White House, he prepared to repeat the performance. In the meantime, the men who had advised Franklin Roosevelt were working to convince Harry Truman of the increasing perfidy of the Soviet Union. Averell Harriman, the shrewd multimillionaire ambassador to Moscow, had rushed to Washington to brief the new president. Truman says Harriman told him the visit was based on the fear that you did not understand, as I have seen Roosevelt understand, that Stalin is breaking his agreements. To soften that condescension, Harriman added that he feared Truman could not have had time to catch up with all the recent cables. The self-educated Missourian prided himself on how many pages of documents he could chew through per day. He was a champion reader, and undercut Harriman's condescension breezily by instructing the ambassador to keep on sending me long messages. Harriman told Truman they were faced with a barbarian invasion of Europe. The Soviet Union, he said, meant to take over its neighbors and install the Soviet system of secret police and state control. He added that he was not pessimistic, the president writes, for he felt that it was possible for us to arrive at a workable basis with the Russians. He believed that this would require a reconsideration of our policy and the abandonment of any illusion that the Soviet government was likely soon to act in accordance with the principles to which the rest of the world held in international affairs. Truman was concerned to convince Roosevelt's advisers that he meant to be decisive. "I ended the meeting by saying I intend to be firm in my dealings with the Soviet government." Delegates were arriving in San Francisco that April, for example, to formulate a charter for a new United Nations to replace the old and defunct League. Harriman asked Truman if he would go ahead with the World Organization plans even if Russia dropped out. Truman remembers responding realistically that without Russia there would not be a world organization. 3 days later, having heard from Stalin in the meantime and met the arriving Soviet foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, he retreated from realism to bluster. "He felt that our agreements with the Soviet Union had so far been a one-way street," an eyewitness recalls, "and that he could not continue. It was now or never. He intended to go on with the plans for San Francisco, and if the Russians did not wish to join us, they could go to hell." Stimson argued for patience. "In the big military matters," Truman reports him saying, "the Soviet government had kept its word and the military authorities of the United States had come to count on it. In fact, they had often done better than they had promised." Although George Marshall seconded Stimson's argument and Truman could not have had two more reliable witnesses, it was not counsel the new and untried president wanted to hear. Marshall added a crucial justification that Truman took to heart. He said from the military point of view the situation in Europe was secure, but that we hoped for Soviet participation in the war against Japan at a time when it would be useful to us. The Russians had it within their power to delay their entry into the Far Eastern War until we had done all the dirty work. He was inclined to agree with Mr. Stimson that the possibility of a break with Russia was very serious. Truman could hardly tell the Russians to go to hell if he needed them to finish the Pacific War. Marshall's justification for patience meant Stalin had the president over a barrel. It was not an arrangement Harry Truman intended to perpetuate. He let Molotov know. They had sparred diplomatically at their first meeting. Now the president attacked. The issue was the composition of the post-war government of Poland. Molotov discussed various formulas, all favoring Soviet dominance. Truman demanded the free elections that he understood had been agreed upon at Yalta. I replied sharply that an agreement had been reached on Poland, and that there was only one thing to do, and that was for Marshal Stalin to carry out that agreement in accordance with his word. Molotov tried again. Truman replied sharply again, repeating his previous demand. Molotov hedged once more. Truman proceeded to lay him low. I expressed once more the desire of the United States for friendship with Russia, but I wanted it clearly understood that this could be only on the basis of the mutual observation of agreements and not on the basis of a one-way street. Those are hardly fighting words. Molotov's reaction suggests that the president spoke more pungently at the time. I have never been talked to like that in my life, Molotov said. I told him, carry out your agreements and you won't get talked to like that. If Truman felt better for the exchange, it disturbed Stimson. The new president had acted without knowledge of the bomb and its potentially fateful consequences. It was time and past time for a full briefing. Truman agreed to meet with Stimson at noon on Wednesday, April 25th. The president was scheduled to address the opening session of the United Nations Conference in San Francisco by radio that evening. One more conditioning incident intervened. On Tuesday, he received a communication from Joseph Stalin, one of the most revealing and disquieting messages to reach me during my first days in the White House. Molotov had reported Truman's tough talk to the Soviet premier. Stalin replied in kind. Poland bordered on the Soviet Union, he wrote, not on Great Britain or the United States. The question of Poland had the same meaning for the security of the Soviet Union as the question of Belgium and Greece for the security of Great Britain. But the Soviet Union was not consulted when those governments were being established there, following the Allied liberation. The blood of the Soviet people abundantly shed on the fields of Poland in the name of the liberation of Poland demanded a Polish government friendly to Russia. And finally, I am ready to fulfill your request and do everything possible to reach a harmonious solution. But you demand too much of me. In other words, you demand that I renounce the interests of security of the Soviet Union, but I cannot turn against my country. With this blunt challenge in his mind, Truman received his Secretary of War. Stimson had brought Groves along for technical backup, but left him waiting in an outer office while he discussed issues of general policy. He began dramatically, reading from a memorandum. Within 4 months, we shall in all probability have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city. We had shared the development with the British, Stimson continued, but we controlled the factories that made the explosive material, and no other nation could reach this position for some years. It was certain that we would not enjoy a monopoly forever, and probably the only nation which could enter into production within the next few years is Russia. The world, in its present state of moral advancement compared with its technical development, the Secretary of War continued quaintly, would be eventually at the mercy of such a weapon. In other words, modern civilization might be completely destroyed. Stimson emphasized what John Anderson had emphasized to Churchill the year before, that founding a world peace organization while the bomb was still a secret would seem to be unrealistic. No system of control heretofore considered would be adequate to control this menace. Both inside any particular country and between the nations of the world, the control of this weapon will undoubtedly be a matter of the greatest difficulty and would involve such thoroughgoing rights of inspection and internal controls as we have never heretofore contemplated. That brought Stimson to the crucial point. Furthermore, in the light of our present position with reference to this weapon, the question of sharing it with other nations, and, if so shared, upon what terms, becomes a primary question of our foreign relations. Bohr had proposed to inform other nations of the common dangers of a nuclear arms race. At the hands of Stimson and his advisers, that sensible proposal had drifted to the notion that the issue was sharing the weapon itself. As commander-in-chief, as a veteran of the First World War, as a man of common sense, Truman must have wondered what on earth his Secretary of War was talking about, especially when Stimson added that a certain moral responsibility followed from American leadership in nuclear technology, which the nation could not shirk without very serious responsibility for any disaster to civilization which it would further. Was the United States morally obligated to give away a devastating new weapon of war? Now Stimson called in Groves. The general brought with him a report on the status of the Manhattan Project that he had presented to the Secretary of War 2 days earlier. Both Stimson and Groves insisted Truman read the document while they waited. The president was restive. He had a threatening note from Stalin to deal with. He had to prepare to open the United Nations conference, even though Stimson had just informed him that allowing the conference to proceed in ignorance of the bomb was a sham. A scene of darkening comedy followed as the proud man who had challenged Averell Harriman to keep sending him long messages tried to avoid public instruction in the minutiae of a secret project he had fought doggedly as a senator to investigate. Groves misunderstood completely. Mr. Truman did not like to read long reports. This report was not long, considering the size of the project. It was about 24 pages, and he would constantly interrupt his reading to say, "Well, I don't like to read papers." And Mr. Stimson and I would reply, "Well, we can't tell you this in any more concise language. This is a big project." For example, we discussed our relations with the British in about 4 or 5 lines. It was that much condensed. We had to explain all the processes, and we might just say what they were, and that was about all. After the reading of the lesson, Groves notes, "A great deal of emphasis was placed on foreign relations, and particularly on the Russian situation," Truman reverting to his immediate problems. "He made it very definite," Groves adds for the record, "that he was in entire agreement with the necessity for the project." Final point in Stimson's memorandum was the proposal Bush and Conant had initiated to establish what Stimson called a select committee for recommending action to the executive and legislative branches of our government. Truman approved. In his memoirs, the president describes his meeting with Stimson and Groves with tact and perhaps even a measure of private humor. "I listened with absorbed interest, for Stimson was a man of great wisdom and foresight. He went into considerable detail in describing the nature and the power of the projected weapon. Burns had already told me that the weapon might be so powerful as to be capable of wiping out entire cities and killing people on an unprecedented scale. That was when Burns had crowed that the new bombs might allow the United States to dictate its own terms at the end of the war. Stimson, on the other hand, seemed at least as much concerned with the role of the atomic bomb in the shaping of history as in its capacity to shorten this war. I thanked him for his enlightening presentation of this awesome subject, and as I saw him to the door, I felt how fortunate the country was to have so able and so wise a man in its service." High praise, but the president was not sufficiently impressed at the outset with Stimson and Harriman to invite either man to accompany him to the next conference of the Big Three. Both found it necessary, when the time came, to invite themselves. Jimmy Burns went at the president's invitation and sat at the president's right hand. Discussion between Truman and his various advisers was one level of discourse in the spring of 1945 on the uses of the atomic bomb. Another was joined 2 days after Stimson and Groves briefed the president, when a target committee under Groves' authority met for the first time in Loris Norstad's conference room at the Pentagon. Brigadier General Thomas F. Farrell, who would represent the Manhattan Project as Groves' deputy to the Pacific Command, chaired the committee. Besides Farrell, it counted 2 other Air Force officers, a colonel and a major, and 5 scientists, including John von Neumann and British physicist William G. Penny. Groves opened the meeting with a variant of his usual speech to Manhattan Project working groups, how important their duty was, how secret it must be kept. He had already discussed targets with the Military Policy Committee and now informed his target committee that it should propose no more than 4. Farrell laid down the basics: B-29 range for such important missions no more than 1,500 miles, visual bombing essential so that these untried and valuable bombs could be aimed with certainty and their effects photographed, probable targets urban or industrial Japanese areas in July, August, or September, each mission to be given 1 primary and 2 alternate targets with spotter planes sent ahead to confirm visibility. Most of the first meeting was devoted to worrying about the Japanese weather. After lunch, the committee brought in the 20th Air Force's top meteorologist, who told them that June was the worst weather month in Japan. A little improvement is present in July, a little bit better weather is present in August, September weather is bad. January was the best month, but no one intended to wait that long. The meteorologist said he could forecast a good day for bombing operations only 24 hours ahead, but he could give 2 days' notice of bad weather. He suggested they station submarines near the target areas to radio back weather readings. Later in the afternoon, they began considering targets. Groves had extended Farrell's guidelines. "I had said as the governing factor that the targets chosen should be places the bombing of which would most adversely affect the will of the Japanese people to continue the war. Beyond that, they should be military in nature, consisting either of important headquarters or troop concentrations, or centers of production of military equipment and supplies. To enable us to assess accurately the effects of the bomb, the targets should not have been previously damaged by air raids. It was also desirable that the first target be of such size that the damage would be confined within it, so that we could more definitely determine the power of the bomb. But such pristine targets had already become scarce in Japan. If the first choice the target committee identified at its first meeting was hardly big enough to confine the potential damage, it was the best the enemy had left to offer. Hiroshima is the largest untouched target not on the 21st Bomber Command priority list. Consideration should be given to this city. Tokyo, the committee notes continue, is a possibility, but it is now practically all bombed and burned out and is practically rubble with only the palace grounds left standing. Consideration is only possible here. The target committee did not yet fully understand the level of authority it commanded. With a few words to Groves, it could exempt a Japanese city from Curtis LeMay's relentless firebombing, preserving it through spring mornings of cherry blossoms and summer nights of wild monsoons for a more historic fate. The committee thought it took second priority behind LeMay rather than first priority ahead, and in emphasizing these mistaken priorities, the colonel who reviewed the 20th Air Force's bombing directive for the committee revealed what the United States policy in Japan, in all its deadly ambiguity, had become.